Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation, recorded live from Bands of America Grand Nationals Marching Band Competition in Indianapolis, Indiana, at Lucas Oil Stadium, with special guest host Claire Krieger-Boaz.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Talking Up Music Education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation. My name is Claire Krieger-Boaz, and I'm sitting in for Mary Lurson. We are here at Bands of America Grand Nationals in Indianapolis at the great Lucas Oil Stadium. My guest today is Joshua Simons, who is the Executive Director of the Percussive Arts Society. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So nice to see you. I have a sort of basic question, which is, what is the Percussive Arts Society? What do you do?
So the Percussive Arts Society is essentially the international organization of drummers and percussionists. We were started in 1961, essentially as an education organization, as a place where like-minded educators could get together. It was actually started at the Midwest Band and Orchestra Clinic because they got together and said, you know, we need an organization of our own. And then since that day, we're now an organization of more than 5,000 students, educators, performers across the world. We're an international organization, and we do whatever we can to inspire future percussionists, to make sure that non-percussionists have the correct percussion education. So everything dealing around with percussion, drums, and in all genres.
What sort of programs do you have? How do you implement that?
We do that in a few different ways. Our largest program is our convention. That's called PASIC. Most people think of PASIC as actually its own organization, actually, but it's just the International Convention of PAS, P-A-S-I-C. People sometimes the light bulb goes off and they're like, ah. And that is a convention. We have about 100 different sessions, masterclass clinics, concerts over the course of 4 days, an expo hall of every major percussion and drum dealer. We also have programs throughout the year, scholarships, different competitions. We have a very robust database of papers, and we have multiple magazines and publications that go out every year. So we do it through education, through performance, through research. Those are the three major areas.
And then you have a museum that you run.
We do. Rhythm Discovery Center. So Rhythm Discovery Center is a museum that started in 2009 when Percussive Arts Society moved to Indianapolis. And it is an interactive drum and percussion museum, the only one in the country. It was started because we have a very large collection of drums and percussion. And we didn't want it just to be a buried collection somewhere behind a vault where no one could see. So we created this museum. It's open to the public, not just percussionists, because we do lots of tours. The NAMM Foundation has been actually instrumental in making sure that we can bring in lots of Indianapolis school students every year to participate in the museum. But it's fully interactive, hand drums and drum sets and everything you can think of. And then we are able to put those different exhibits out constantly. We just finished two new exhibits that went up just yesterday in time for Bands of America and PASIC. And then in addition to the museum, where it's very interactive, we have about 3,000 different pieces of different items in a behind what we call behind the glass that we can constantly be moving in and out. So we can constantly be showcasing new pieces.
What is the sort of the makeup, the demographic? Is it mostly adults, professionals, or students? What's the sort of the range, age range?
It's been changing. Originally, it was very university centered, both in student and educator. Today, we are reaching out on both sides in terms of reaching out to more high school students. And also more hobbyists, lots of drum set players, hobbyists. And then a lot of people who are maybe done with their career, but still want to give back. It's still a very important part of who they are. Someone once told me that, you know, the thing about PAS, in addition to being an association, when we have PASIC, it's more like a family reunion. Being that drums and percussion are still, you know, those people whose names are on a lot of the instruments are still with us or have just unfortunately recently passed, you know, Remo Belli and Vic Firth, Mike Balter, who's, you know, a great gentleman, been part of PAS for many years. You have Neil Grover. So all these instruments with the people's name on it, you can still go up and talk to them, which is something very rare in the music world. So it's a great opportunity to get to know the people who, you know, have written the book, literally written the book that you might be studying out of. My first meeting there, we have a meeting with boards of advisors and past presidents, and you have these monumental musicians and educators sitting there at this table, Garwood Whaley and John Beck, and just so many more people, Anthony Cerrone, and your mind's kind of blown, but you've been put in this position to see this organization through the next side, but these people are the ones who started it. And you're just hopefully making some positive moves forward. But it's so important to them. That's why they're still there, because they essentially started this organization and you want to follow through with it.
So I'm curious what, if any, part of your mission or organizational strategy is to encourage new percussion players, and then sub-question, creating more diversity in that field. I know generally in the music industry, there's a push for this at NAMM and the NAMM Foundation. All of those iconic drummers you named, and I didn't hear any women. So I'm curious, as far as encouraging young women into going into being a drummer, rock and roll drummer or percussionist, is there a movement there at all?
There is. And I will apologize to our Hall of Famers, Evelyn Glennie and Keiko Abe and current amazing women percussionists, Julie Hill and Julie Davila and Rebecca Kite and Lauren Vogel Weiss. There are so many women who have our trailblazers. We recently, a few years ago, started actually a diversity alliance at PAS to address this topic. And I appreciate you bringing it up. Essentially, for gender and race, socioeconomic, geographic, we want to make sure that everyone knows that PAS is a place where they can come, but also make sure that percussionists, no matter where they go, that everyone has the same opportunity for education, college, and you name it. So it's something that we took head on, knowing that when we did data and findings, we were going to see things that we knew were true. Some of those perceptions were going to be true in terms of lots of men and Caucasian. But we were facing it head on, saying, yes, this organization was started many years ago by that. And so the only way you can make change is first to identify and say, okay, this is a problem. And now how do we continue to make it better? So we've done that. And we created this so that we're not, it's not to shame and say, oh, PAS is only this and that. It's to say, okay, what are we going to do to make sure that there is more representation in the Hall of Fame, in sessions, in day of percussion, you name it. And we're doing those things right now.
That's terrific. And it's so important to, I think, for the health and growth of an organization to really look at how it got started and be willing to evolve and change and incorporate everyone. So it's not a girl drummer. It's just a drummer.
It's just a drummer. And that's also another thing. We're the percussive art society. Percussive, and for a long time, people might say, well, we weren't as open to marching drums or drum set. So it's more than just, it's diversity, but diversity also is in terms of how much, we're putting into these other things. We have Drum Fest. We have, I think, 18 of the most amazing drum set players in the world coming. We have, Carolina Crown has been there. Blue Doubles have been there. This year's Boston Crusaders coming in. We have WGI groups who come in. So, then we have timpanists and international world musicians. So diversity is a very big topic, big word, and it fits lots of different instruments and genres and you name it. So
it's something like we address. Well, it sounds like you're coming at that from multiple angles, which is pretty great.
Absolutely. You asked a question about new percussionists.
Right. You mentioned you were in high schools. We're here at Bands of America. There we have drumline drummers and marching band, but back to the diversity of types of drummers and percussionists.
Percussionists.
Yes.
I think it's important that we are the marching band world, the marching arts, I'll say, is a very, it's large. There's so many kids who are interested in it. And we want to just make sure that they then have additional resources. If they want to dive into something really specific, we want to be there. So we've created opportunities for a lot of these high school students to become members, to get free resources, to attend PASIC. Usually when I go to these things, they've never heard of PAS, which is totally fine. It's a larger issue. But as soon as I mention PASIC, then their eyes light up. They're like, oh my God, I love PASIC. I want to go. I'm like, it goes back to the first thing. Well, PASIC isn't who we are. It's what we do. One of the things, and getting them to understand, there's opportunities for you to study or meet some great teachers if you're interested in, it's a very large networking opportunity too, as a lot of associations are. A lot of students can come meet university teachers or opportunity to study with someone, do different lessons. In terms of actually starting young percussionists from ground zero, not necessarily something we do right now. We're obviously always out there advocating for that percussionists. You can start percussion on day one. A long time ago, there was this thing where, you couldn't play percussion until you played something else. Or when I studied abroad when I was in college, and when I showed up, they asked me what my second instrument was, because no one just plays percussion. So this idea that it's being a percussionist, should be proud of it, but let's learn from day one. It's okay to start, you got to play the trumpet first, and then you can go to drums if you want to. Why? Why don't we make you play the drums first before you can go? I think everyone should actually play the drums because you become better at rhythm.
It's really interesting you say that. So I have a son in middle school, and when he started middle school last year in sixth grade, he came in wanting to be a drummer. And when they were assigning instruments and they put them in percussion, and everybody was sitting down putting together their trumpets and their saxophones and their trombones and their clarinets, he gave up immediately on day one, decided he didn't want to do percussion because he wanted to be able to take something home, and he didn't want to take home a shaker. And so I've been curious ever since then, and maybe you have some thoughts on that. How do you get kids interested? Is there a sweet spot in the age where if their other kids are getting to put together instruments and the percussion kids are standing in the back waiting, how do you get them interested and engaged young enough for it to stick?
So that's an amazing question. And it's something we deal with all the time. And I think every teacher who's a percussionist is constantly trying to get their colleagues to understand there are tools you can use to make sure that the drummers and percussionists in the back are not bored. People don't understand how to incorporate them into the larger training, the warm-ups. And there are so many resources out there, something that we have a ton of resources of. Like I said, we're not just for percussionists. We want to make sure that people are teaching percussion education correctly. Sometimes people have been in the room for 15, 20 years. The only thing they've ever done was taken a methods course, and they can maybe do a paradiddle or remember what a paradiddle was. That's not going to help those kids. And I was one of those, you know, people talk about the drummers and percussionists in the back. Well, they're bored. You know, you can go in, and I was talking to someone yesterday who, a band director who was a percussionist at a clinic, and he was there observing the band director, and he had a stopwatch out, which he always does. He said in the 45-minute session, the drummers played for 7 minutes. So if you're always cutting out the times where they play, if you're not engaging them some of the way, they want to do something else. So those are ways that we can do it. I mean, so many companies make instruments that they can bring home for kids. I mean, we're here at Bands of America, which is presented by Yamaha. And, you know, they have great kits where they're xylophone and glockenspiel. A lot of the manufacturers have them that you can take home and put together and play.
Yeah, we have a digital drum kit in our garage. And we also had, I bought him the drum head, you know, so he could practice. But it was just something about that first day when all the other kids were getting the shiny
things.
Drums
always have to be quiet at home, but people don't mind a loud and bad trumpet player.
Alto saxophone player, right? Learning.
Violin. I'll take a beginning, not bad. I'll take a beginning percussionist over a beginning violin.
I'm
going to
tell you why. We live in a townhouse, so we have shared walls. So we couldn't do drums. And I think that there's just something about neighbors hearing drums versus neighbors hearing other instruments. And I will tell you that he practices the alto sax in the garage. And currently, he is learning tequila. And so I get to do the Pee Wee Herman dance while he plays, which is pretty fun. I would like to jump into sort of your path from a young man being drawn to the drums, standing in the back with a shaker however it was.
I was drawn to the piano first.
Oh, the piano. Okay.
Yeah.
So piano,
I played piano fourth grade.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it.
You did?
I loved it. Fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. And then it all changed. The junior high band came to my elementary school. And to do one of those, so I went to a K through sixth, and then we had seventh, eighth grade, junior high school, and then high school, 9 through 12. So sixth grade, junior high school comes, the band plays. I was like, I got to do that. So afterwards, after the assembly, walked up to the band director, Mrs. Claus. I said, I want to be in the band. And she said, great, what do you play? I said, I play the piano. She's like, great, you can play the xylophone. I was like, awesome. What's that? The rest is history.
Did you play the xylophone?
I did. So show up seventh grade, got all the xylophone and Glock parts. That was seventh grade year. And talking about being bored and rowdy, there were three boys who played the drums, bass drum, snare drum, all the other stuff. You know, getting into trouble, whatever, their teacher would give them the pencils.
Give them the pencils?
Yeah, when you play too loud, you have to use pencils with erasers on the other end. Or at least you did 30 years ago. Then one day I went over and I looked at their music and I said, wait a minute, we're playing the same thing, but you only have to hit one thing. And I have to do lots of notes, but you're just doing the same notes over and over again. I want to do that instead. So that and something else also happened. I went and tried out for the district jazz band on piano. And there was another kid there who was just unbelievably amazing. And so he got the part. But the director said, well, why don't I just teach you drum set? And you can do the drum set for the district jazz band. So I was like, sure. But then, so then I kind of went over to that and then high school drum line and then did drum corps. And I like how I spent the most of my time on my middle school time, but then just kind of whizzed right through like high school. And yeah.
You know? Well, there is almost nothing more exciting than a drum line, I will say.
I love, obviously, I'm a band kid at heart. You know, lunches in the band room and all my friends being band members. And I marched drum corps. I was introduced to drum corps when I was in high school and did front ensemble. I was a timpanist. And I strongly believe that if you can bring 3 truckloads of props, that you can somehow fit 4 timpani. I don't want to hear this. They're too hard to move around. More and more people are not putting timpani in their front ensemble. Drum corps, WGI, bands, and I hear they're just so big.
Well, so this brings up an interesting issue, though, which is a very smooth transition into equity and access, because there are some of these bands that you're seeing with the 4 semis filled with ladders and volcanoes, which are amazing. And then you have schools that are coming in on yellow school buses and sleeping on the floor in gymnasiums around town, and maybe they have homemade costumes. And so I'm curious, just sort of generally, you have this international organization living in a city with some pretty significant financial challenges in the school district, and how you navigate being this international organization, having to have your eye on all of these different larger picture issues. And then right here in the center of where your offices are, you've got all of these challenges in the public school system. And how do you balance that? What's your tether to the local community? And do you bring what's going on here in Indiana public schools to the national conversation, international conversation, in some cases, with your other partners?
Not as much as we should. And maybe that's just my fault for, you know, only being here for 2.5 years. And the first thing you do is you kind of take a while to look at the landscape. And you don't want to just react right away. You know, hopefully it's a long-term thing. But as an international, national organization, we do make sure that we are as tied into the city as possible. The Marching Arts is a little interesting, because obviously just being a percussion organization, we're not talking about the whole band the whole time, but there's still an advocacy part about doing what we can do to make sure that there is that access no matter what. I mean, I think just arts education in general, as a national, international organization, just being a constant voice around that to make sure that people know there's many layers of support that they can go to. So we can add our name talks. I think we can go to the meetings and you know, we're asked to show up to different city hall meetings or different school board meetings to offer support and why. And
You're asked by the schools to do that? Or
we're asked by other partner organizations as well, who might be taking a larger lead. So here we have the Indiana Arts Education Network, who's been great in trying to fill.
Run by former NAMM chair Mark Goff from Pages Music.
Yes. And there are different organizations all around the country. But when you can show up and show that being unified and together and come across and say, I'm not worried about this organization or that organization, together, you know, we go to the Capitol. We definitely are lobbying. I would definitely say lobbying, you know, knowing the difference between lobbying and advocacy, things will come up that we're like, no, you need to sign this to make sure that there is actual, you know, money being put towards something. So we live in an interesting state when it comes to the budget and education, and some of it, they just in dealing with ESSA and people not understanding exactly how some of that money flows. So it's up to us to really know as much as we can, so then we can share it with those who are actually making the decisions.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot. No, I mean, I think it's sort of rampant issue. Same thing with NAMM and the NAMM Foundation. We are in a national, international organization that has our hand in lots of state advocacy issues. And so we created these state coalitions. The Indiana one is actually the model that we hold up to our other state partners because of how successful and organized it is. And I've watched this coalition grow and evolve over the last several years, and getting really savvy on when they plan meetings and who's at the table. And I've been at a few of those meetings over the years, and it's really impressive. And I think it's becoming so clear that the action really is taking place and has to at the local level. It has to be grassroots. It has to come from the people that are in the schools and parents and organizations, because it doesn't work when it comes from top down.
No, the model you're talking about is something that we use right with PAS, and that is doing things in our community that then others can see and take it back to their own community. So whether we're bringing in a drum circle, you know, to a school to show something and creating a different curriculum or arts education or using the arts education network, doing something as well as we can do here, showing people to get together, showing how you can do it in your own community. I think that's the best how we can be as a national organization to actually show how we're doing it here, and then give them the tools to be able to take to their own community. We can't get to every community. We're just too small, you know, PAS. But we have chapters set up in every state. We have educators from every corner you can think of. And if we can say, hey, listen, we have their ear. You know, if we can get our information right from NAFME and American for the Arts and from the Indian Arts Education Network, and we can be a voice also, I'm at that table, so I can bring it and then I can then share it with the rest of mine, right? That's just how it works, you know, telling them all, this is how you can do it. Some of them don't have time. So they're looking for that, to me, to say, okay, here's what you need to do, 1, 2, and 3. And if you can do this, we're going to continue to spread it. So that's how we do it with advocacy. That's how we do it with our education. We really are trying to bring in top minds, think about what's great, and then help spread it out, you know, the rest of the way we can.
Right. Same with the NAM Foundation. We convene our partners and our NAM members we do Day of Service in Washington, D.C. every year, and we do one in Anaheim. And we just sort of created a step-by-step, we call it a toolkit, but it's a guide. So somebody could come in and bring it to their school and say, hey, let's show everybody what it's like to have music program for a day. And then maybe somebody will take up that mantle. So I think the modeling and then giving people the guide to the model is a great way to handle that. Quickly, I'm curious about, did you have a music teacher that influenced you? In one of our earlier episodes, the host called it somebody who flipped your switch onto music, where you just knew this is who you are now.
I had a few, and they were my public school teachers from elementary school, junior high, and high school.
Who was the first one? Do you remember his or her name?
Yeah, his name was Dan Coons. And he was my elementary school, and he actually passed away at an early age. Someone who a lot of kids were affected by. He was just one of those, you know, went around to all the different elementary schools, showed up in his jacket and his tie. You know, my father was a high school teacher, and back in that day, all teachers, you know, they dressed up, you know, and so did your teacher. And I remember having missed my keyboard, playing my keyboard there, but it was. I got to go to the cafeteria and I got to do that. And it was just, it was fun. And we all played together. And then Mrs. Claus, she's great. Still keep in touch with her today.
I love the idea of throughout a person's life, there might be somebody that sort of gently or maybe more not so gently changes your life trajectory. And I know, I have a teacher in college, there was a dean of students who saw something in me that they nurtured and it. Every time I would slightly pivot or I would change my mind about who I thought I was or what my limitations were or weren't. And for me, that music teacher was Ms. McGlynn in fifth grade. And I took clarinet and piano with her, which was amazing. And I got so much out of it, not even for the music, but just for the sense of belonging and feeling connected to something outside of your own sort of childhood drama. And I wonder if you have, were these teachers for you sort of these, like, I just think about them as these touch points in your life when you think about, then I met this person, then I met this person.
For me, some of those people have really happened post high school. I was a pretty lazy student and music was the only thing in general. Less teacher, music was the only thing that really, that's the only reason I wanted to go to school. I have three siblings, all three of them extremely smart. My brother, who's 2 years older than me, was a valedictorian. Joshua was not. I got all A's in band, but even my parents who were public school teachers didn't understand that until I was probably around a junior in high school. And then they finally realized, all right, it's okay if he doesn't do the best in biology. And that's even my parents who are public school teachers, you know, they're the first, but they finally like, okay. And then it was about what do we have to do for college and everything moving forward. But to get to where I am today, I definitely think the turning point was my second high school. I actually switched high schools my senior year so I could study with a different teacher. Long story, I won't get into it. So I could actually prepare for college with this other band director who then worked with me after school every day, who helped me get into Long Beach State as a percussion major. And then at Long Beach State, I met Professor Dr. Michael Carney, who put me on this kind of path. But then it was around my junior year where I was always a pretty good percussionist. So after that, I wanted to play timpani. We mentioned that once before. So I studied with Rainer Carroll of the LA Philharmonic, who today is still a great friend. But I was never going to replace him. And I didn't know if I was going to be the guy who wanted to go run around to this symphony and that and do all that stuff. And coming from my parents who had these very stable jobs with the family, and I just didn't know if the gigging musician was for me. And so when I was a junior in college, I went and I called up the Long Beach Symphony. And I said, are you looking for an intern? Now, this was the only reason I did that was because my brother, who was the valedictorian, went to law school and he got an internship. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. Except for his internship, I think, bought him a Beamer. And my internship got me...
The Symphony?
No, got me access to development files. I could read about grants. A little bit different than the nonprofit world. So I go and I have an internship at the Long Beach Symphony. And that was really my starting of, I love this. Percussion and music, I love, but... I was always the guy who could make sure everything was set up correctly, right? I was the section leader because, not because I was the best player, but because I'll tell you, all the parts were marked, everything was set up way beforehand, we were there. And then that's where I met the person who then said, you need to do this for the rest of your life. And that would be Joanne Folletta, the great conductor of the Buffalo Philharmonic and Virginia Symphony and the Long Beach Symphony when I was there. And Joanne has been a great mentor of mine and still is to this day. And she said, you need to do arts management or orchestra management. So after I left Long Beach with my degree in percussion, I went to American University in Washington, D.C., where I have a master's in arts management. From there, I then continued in the orchestra world and worked at the Chicago Youth Symphony for 14 years in different capacities, ending in executive director. And then a friend of mine called me and said, hey, you know, the Percussive Arts Society is looking for a new executive director. And I was like, wow, that's an organization I haven't heard in a very long time. And they're not going to want me. I run a youth orchestra. But ended up talking to them and realized, okay, this is an organization that definitely needs a little bit of help in terms of just the general management and how we run a proper nonprofit. But so I had some of these definitely going back to these key people. But Joanne is still someone to this day who has... I mean, you have someone like that who, you know, I may only talk to her once a year, once every 2 years, but she's, if you've never met her, she's the type of person who remembers something about everyone and will always at that point make you feel like you're the most special person. That's the thing I learned from her is, you know, remember everything about everybody. Remember their dog's name. She would be in a donor reception. She'd be like, how's Fluffy? You know, and the donor's just like, oh, you remember. And I was like, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to remember every single person I meet and something about every single one of them.
Well, I think that is amazing. And I'm so happy that you're still in touch with her. And your varied career is very interesting to me because going to request to be an intern takes motivation. And I can't imagine just thinking that you would get it. And then you did. That's pretty great.
I said, do you need an intern? Yeah. And they said, okay, you're going to work in the development department. And going back to like when I first didn't know what a xylophone was, I said, great. What's development? You know, right. I'm a 20-year-old percussionist.
I mean, right?
I had no idea how to run, you know, but I wanted to get to, and I think this in general for all young musicians and older musicians at this point, no matter how old you are, you really can't be, I think, great unless you understand all parts of everything you do.
Right.
You know, every single part of it. And I think if the musicians really understood what administration does and administration really understood what musicians do, things would be a lot better. But there's so much separation and no one respects, I think, what each person does. And it's unfortunate, you know, because both sides are really hard. Right. To be an amazing musician is really hard. But you know what? To run a nonprofit arts organization is really hard.
Right. You take it on the chin, right? Quite a bit. And you have to get up and keep going.
You do.
Well, the other thing I sort of enjoy quite a bit about your story are all of the career possibilities there are for a musician. You can still play and gig and also make money. Not a ton of money if you're in a nonprofit, but you're fighting the good fight. And it's a really valuable lesson because I think a lot of kids come up still thinking either they're going to be a famous performer. YouTube, Instagram doesn't really help with that sense of possibility of fame. So I like how it was a little gritty. You had some grit to you. I'm super curious what you think the call to action is for music and arts service organizations, nonprofits. What's our call to action? What should we be doing to improve equity and access to music and arts in schools?
First thing we need to do is leave our egos at the door. We need to check that. And now I get it. Everyone is always still just fighting for their own organization. When you're a nonprofit and you're having to make and get grants and everyone's kind of competing for the same money, that makes it tough sometimes because you're still always, you know, can you go into a room with three other colleagues and really not try to tout your organization? It's hard to go in there and you get one shot, let's say, meeting with, someone who has the ability to make change from a, you know, political person. You got to make sure the people you're with are on the same page. And until we get on the same page, that's actually really hard. That can be frustrating. Who are we looking out for? Are we looking out for the kids or are we looking out for ourselves? So we all need to come together and make sure that we are collaborating to make sure that there's a greater good. And if you're not quite there yet, then you're not welcome at the table. I think we have to be okay to actually say you're not welcome at the table because you're actually not on the same page. And then together, we can really make some positive change. We're not really willing to share everything because you don't want to give so that way. We need to have a little more faith in each other and say that we're not going to, you know, stab each other in the back and run and, you know, ask this donor for money or whatever it may be. We really have to be together on this larger issue of making sure that everyone has the same, you know, access. There's not, it goes back to the question you asked earlier. You know, you have these groups coming in with, you know, 10 semis and coach buses and, you know, can travel up from wherever. And then you have the other, you know, groups that are coming in on school buses and sleeping on the floor. I don't have the answer. I don't think anyone has the answer yet, but I want to work with those people who are willing to focus on that and focus on that only and not start getting into the, what can my organization do? Well, no, what can we do for them? Let's just dive in. Let's stop having so many meetings.
These are complicated times, right? Pretty divisive. We've had a lot of tragedies this last year. I see and hear and feel, you know, there's a place for music and healing and coming together and all those kinds of things. And I wonder what you think about that. And what is music's role? What are organizations that have this shared mission and desire to create more music makers and provide equity and access and advocate for all of the reasons to play music? It's fun. It makes you feel better. It improves your mood, your memory, all of it. You age better. All of the reasons. You heal better. What do you see as the role of music? Is there a role for music in healing this time right now?
Well, I think music is such a personal, you know, it just is very personal. So yes, I mean, I think everyone deals with trauma differently, whether it's family or yourself or how you feel the world is being treated right now. Some people cry. Some people sing. Some people.
Do we hear the kids out there?
They do. I love it. So, and some people, it's just about getting lost in music, you know, whether it's listening to music, playing music.
But even people after tragedies with these candlelight vigils and such, they come together and there's music there. They're singing. They're putting.
It brings out such emotion.
It does, right? And it's unifying. Does.
It is. In drums in particular, and percussion is something that we talk about. We talk about access and things that are accessible, bringing a whole bunch of drums to a place. I always see people say, I don't have any rhythm. I'm like, well, first of all, everyone has rhythm because we all have a heartbeat and that's rhythm. Now, you may not be able to create a really groovy beat, but that's not rhythm. Everyone's rhythm. You can also, the thing about drums is, right, it's spontaneous. It's instant. People can play it right away. So you can give someone that opportunity immediately, and especially in times like that, where you just need to get lost a little bit and do something else. Drums and percussion are a great way to do it. You know, interactive drumming, or what people used to call drum circles. But interactive drumming is a fantastic way of having that opportunity for anyone can right away. You can't pick up a French horn right away and play it. You could, it's going to be more frustrating than pleasing. But having I think drums and percussion, so whether it's singing or things that are immediate, I think does really help in some of those times.
I've been in a number of drum circles. My very first one, I thought this is going to be a nightmare because I thought, same, I have no rhythm, I have no this, I have no that. And I was completely transported by the collective consciousness that developed through the great John Fitzgerald.
The great leading, John Fitzgerald.
Leading this drum circle. And I just felt euphoric afterwards. I mean, truly, it was really transformational. And I don't think you know that until you do it. And so I think that's a really great point.
I've come 180 degrees on drum circles. When I was in college, I had the whole my nose up. You know, I was a percussion major. You know, we don't do drum circles because that's just a hippie drummer. You know, djembe on a beach.
That's djembe. What I thought
that's
too.
A joke.
That's what I
djembe. But having a facilitator who really knows what they're doing and can bring people together, whether you're the greatest drummer in the world or don't know how to do it, it doesn't matter, right? Because it's about just feeling inclusive. So when we're talking about going out into a school, bringing different people together of all different walks of life, it doesn't matter at that moment. I think that's really one of the beautiful things about music and drums in particular is it doesn't matter whether, you know, black, white, Christian, Jewish, right, left, it doesn't matter. Coming together and doing something and just letting the music and all that, you know, speak for itself is an amazing thing.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, I know, and then a lot of the veterans programs are looking into drum circles and music to try to help ease some of the PTSD symptoms.
We go to children's hospitals.
I'm sure we're all thinking about it every time there's one of these mass shootings, or what can we do? You know, could we bring in a drum circle to a traumatized community? Would it help for a moment? I don't know. I just was thinking about it, and I was curious on your take.
You know, it was after I lived in Washington, D.C. on September 11th, 2001. And, you know, after you kind of question, you know, here I am, a nonprofit arts agent, what can we do? But I was an intern actually at the National Symphony when we did the Concert for America. Mm. And to see that be thrown together. And it was a moment where there was going to be time for policy. There was going to be time to give money to lots of great organizations, or since then, whether it's cancer research or AIDS research or you name it. But there's something about the soul and just your mind and going away. And music definitely helps with that. And it's not to say that it's the only thing, right? We're silly to say, well, you should only give, you know, you should only support for that. No, it's one of many things that I think that helps the individual out. But it's a very important part.
Well, I have a loaded question for you. This is the big gotcha question. Who is your favorite drummer?
Drummer? Percussionist?
Percussionist.
My daughter? The next kid who starts playing? I am a huge fan of Neil Peart.
Yes.
And it's not Pert.
Well, as you know, I saw Rush in 1990 at Giant Stadium.
And you just saw the R40 kit.
I did.
At Rhythm Discovery Center.
And I was in
awe. Thank you to DW and Sabian and Mr. Peart for making that happen.
Mr. Peart, if you're listening.
I'm sure he is.
I would love to meet you someday.
Me too.
I know. I hope that you stay in touch.
I will. I will come see you in January.
Sounds great. At the NAMM show.
What's happening in January? What should these listeners do in January?
They should attend the NAMM show in Anaheim, California. Definitely.
I'm sure a lot of young students are going to listen to me, so I'm going to share this. So what else
should
they?
Yeah. Well, not too young, because you need to be in college.
That's what I mean.
At least, yeah. College music students should register for the NAMM show at nam.org/GenNext, GENNEXT.
And they can email you?
They can email me at clairek@nam.org, clairek@namm.org. And where can people come play with some percussion and maybe meet you?
We can have a drum circle here at Rhythm. Then come to PASIC. Come to NAMM and find me.
Okay.
TMEA, WGI, DCI, Bands of America. I'm everywhere.
Thank you for joining me today on Talking Up Music Education, coming to you from Bands of America Grand Nationals in Indianapolis, Indiana. Thanks, Joshua.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community, or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. NAMM. That's Mary L. N-A-M-M.